All right. Welcome to class today. Glad to be seen by all of you, I guess. I wish I could see you, but you know, not everything works out the way we wish. There was some conversation about changing the deadline, so some at least preliminary work has been done there. We moved it to TLB at least till Thursday. I have a video conference with most of the TAs later on this afternoon evening. Where we'll talk about some other odds and ends and see if we're going to move other assignments as well. I expect we will. And likely we will do that by picking one of the assignments and removing it altogether. Whether that will be pipeline or fork, I'm not yet sure. It might be dining philosophers. Anyway, we will adjust that and have more for that on Wednesday. I've also slightly tweaked TLB. I removed the requirement that you submit a make file at all and the corresponding tests in the final grade so that your preliminary grade is a more accurate reflection of your final grade. So I figured we've done enough make file things and this one wasn't very interesting, so I just removed it. I think that's that sort of material I have to share. Any thoughts, comments, questions, things for me? Is a C minus in here passing as well? Yeah, this is a weird thing. So the university has traditionally considered a passing grade to be a D or better in courses. The CS department has recognized that people that get Ds and D pluses tend to fail subsequent courses and so have made C minus a prerequisite for other courses. However, the university, the same group that decided D was passing, when they decided that credit, no credit was the default grading model for this semester, unless you opt into a letter grade, decided that credit was given at C, not at C minus. This is decided at the university level, and we are told we don't have control over that. So if you opt credit, no credit, then you need a C to get credit. If you opt for a letter grade, you will get your letter grade and will be able to continue in courses as long as you have a passing grade, which for all courses here won't require a particular, nope, I take it back. Operating systems will require you have at least a C minus in this class to take the next class, whereas other classes will just merely need you to have at least a D. So we have some people saying Florian is doing something else. That maybe. I'm just telling you what I've been told by the provost. We also have a comment here that is, this is an all or nothing choice, or can you pick which classes you're graded credit, no credit? That hasn't been made clear to me yet, the logistics of how this will work. We are told that the registrar will handle the credit, no credit decisions rather than faculty, but I don't know how they're doing that. I would comment though, that if you opt for a credit, if they allow per course decisions and you have a year of your transcript where some of your classes have letter grades and some of them have credit, it is going to be much harder to explain that to a recruiter than if you have a semester of entirely credits where you could say that was the semester of COVID-19. So I personally would go all or nothing just for what this looks like on your transcript later on. Even if they allow you to go piecemeal. But if they allow you to go piecemeal, that's a decision you can make individually. They said they would put a note on the transcript. Yes, so they are planning to put on a transcript text that says this is caused by the COVID-19 lockdown. But if that is shown for some classes and not others in the same semester, again, how do you explain to your recruiter, if they ask, how that happened? You may be able to do it, but it seems like it'd be a little bit of a trick. There's a question about, can you remove files from the submissions on Kytos? Currently the answer is no, I can, you can't. So if you really need a file to go away, email me the file that you need to have removed and I can fairly straightforwardly do that. I believed you were supposed to be able to also upload a blank file, but some people override the one that's there, but some people say that isn't working. So it probably the simplest thing is to just ask me to remove it if you need something to be gone. I hope I got all the questions there. Other questions people have? Other things we should talk about before we dive into synchronization and pthreads? Okay, then let us dive into synchronization and pthreads. So last class, we started going through our different synchronization primitives, and we talked about semaphores primarily and a little bit how those could be used to implement mutual exclusion, is to lock out other threads from access to a particular block of code while you're accessing it. And a little bit about the difference between binary and counting semaphores and how they could simulate different kinds of things. Today we're going to talk about the remaining set of this and potentially, depending on how quickly that goes, see some example code actually in C with pthreads library. But let us dive into one of the more awkward terms here, the condition variable. I call the condition variable an awkward term because it is not a variable and isn't clearly a condition either. The central idea of a condition variable is really this idea of the wait queue. There are some other elements to it, but the central idea is that there is some data structure, maybe not even a queue, but some data structure that is used to store the threads that aren't ready to continue. So when we talked about the mutex and even the semaphore, we talked about the idea that you will wait until something is available. Well, that waiting concept in practice, we usually want to instead be some data structure that stores who is waiting. And part of the reason we want a data structure to do that is so that we can handle when multiple threads are waiting for something and only one resource becomes available, who gets that? That decision can be fairly important because it can change the relative priority of the threads and which ones make progress most quickly. And so the condition variable has a little bit of other ideas in principle. It may have a queue of threads that are ready but not yet running if we have more processors or more threads than processors. And in principle, there is this notion of an assertion, this thing that needs to be true before things can run. However, the assertion is often stored only implicitly and the ready queue is optional. So the condition variable in general is a queue or other data structure, a data structure storing threads that are waiting for something to become the case. And sorry about its name. I have yet to program with a condition variable manually, except when exercises trying to design me to understand how other things are built. Condition variables are almost always used as part of a monitor, which we will discuss next. So you hear condition variable, think data structure of threads, and that's probably the most important thing to understand there. A monitor is probably the most common implementation of a lock that we find today. It is a paired mutex and condition variable. And as I talk about this, you'll likely think to yourself, wait a minute, this just sounds like a binary semaphore. And it is like that, but with more control, more design here to keep it from doing bad things. So the idea here of a monitor is that you can either wait for something to become true. So there's some definition of what should be true or false. And you can wait for it to become true. And when you wait for it to become true, you enter a condition variables queue. So you enter this data structure of waiting threads. And you can signal or notify the monitor. You can say, a resource has become available, let somebody add it. And so when you go in to wait, you have to wait for some other thread to signal. And then there is also a third one, the broadcast or notify all, that says, let everybody that's waiting come awake, no matter what's going on. But that is much less commonly used than the wait and signal. Wait and signal or wait and notify are the most common ways of implementing locks in current languages today. There'll be a monitor, it'll have a data structure to store the threads that are waiting, potentially some sort of priority inside that data structure, other than just first come, first serve, although it could be first come, first serve. And then when you want to enter something, you go to wait until somebody signals back, and this is how we provide the basic locking kind of behavior. This is what is built into languages with things like the synchronized keyword in Java that we mentioned, even though apparently you hadn't seen it before, or some of you hadn't. But there's these sort of the language level constructs usually use monitors. And part of the reason they usually use monitors is because monitors are designed to prevent inappropriate use. So because things are handled with data structures and they have their own internal queues and so forth, they can make guarantees that only the appropriate number of threads receive a resource, that if you go to, that when you leave something, you release it and so forth. So very often when you hear about a lock or a synchronization tool in general, it's implemented as a monitor, which is internally somewhat complex, likely has a binary semaphore, likely has a condition variable that is, say, a data structure of things going on. As part of how it's built, it may have some extra pieces as well to ensure that the tool itself can't be broken, that it will always do what it's supposed to do. You can still misuse it, but it will always work correctly. So when you are thinking about what's the difference between a semaphore and a monitor, think monitor is higher level and stores the threads that are waiting in a data structure. Whereas a semaphore is lower level and trusts the operating system to handle how things wait and when they resume. And then we have the reader-writer lock. The reader-writer lock is fundamentally different than these other pieces. Arguably, the other things we've been talking about sort of were all building up to more refined ways of blocking things out. But the reader-writer lock has two different modes. It has the read mode, which as many things as want to can do at once, and the write mode, that only one thing can do at a time and nobody else can read while it's happening. Okay? So we talked a little bit when we were first setting this up several weeks ago now about the idea of a sidewalk. Lots of people can walk on the sidewalk. That would be sort of the read action. But only one, but if somebody decides to lay new cement, then only they can lay the new cement and nobody else can walk on the sidewalk while that's happening. It acts like the write. So there's an exclusive mode and a shared mode. The exclusive mode being the write, the shared being the read. There are several implementations of reader-writer locks, and they vary in a key important point. So if we look at this question here, if a writer is waiting for all the readers to be done and a new reader arrives, should that reader be allowed in or remain to wait for the writer to finish first? Okay, so if we go back to the sidewalk analogy, if somebody has come to replace a thing of sidewalk and is waiting for people to finish walking on that piece of sidewalk before they do it, and somebody else wants to walk across that sidewalk, are they going to be stopped by the person that's waiting to lay new sidewalk? Or are they going to be allowed to pass as well, and the person that will lay new sidewalk will wait for a moment when nobody's walking? And there are both, there's arguments for both versions. And so in practice, it's not uncommon to have both read-preferring and write-preferring reader-writer locks available in a threading library. So you can pick which one you want. Do you want the writer to be able to block all readers even while some readers are already there, or do you want to let as many readers as you want in? And they sort of prioritize different kinds of behaviors, and both exist. Under the hood, they're generally implemented with a few different monitors or mutexes, and a couple of extra variables to sort of track what's going on. A counter is the simplest version. And so they're not that difficult to make out of the other pieces, but they're enough moving pieces that getting them exactly right is a little tricky. So they're almost always implemented in the library as a thing you can just use. Any thoughts, comments, questions so far? All right, let's talk about barriers, and then we'll try to summarize our synchronization, then we'll come back to transaction, which really isn't quite the same thing. A barrier, so reader-writer locks and mutexes and monitors and semaphores, all at some level, have this idea of trying to have some region of code that you're blocking other threads from coming into in some circumstances. The barrier has a different kind of goal. Instead of trying to block things from getting somewhere, you're trying to assure they all get there together. So the concept here is that when you come to the barrier, you just sort of arrive. This will increment an internal counter. And if that counter hasn't reached some pre-configured number, Let's suppose I have a barrier that waits for 4 threads to arrive. If I'm thread 1 through 3, then when I get to the barrier, I get suspended. But then once thread 4 comes along, all 4 of the threads, the one that just arrived and the 3 that were waiting, all are allowed to continue to the next piece of code. And barriers are, there's specific instances where they're useful. You'll get to see one of those as we do the life programming assignment here in a couple weeks. They tend to be a little bit complicated under the hood, but they're sort of designed to help things progress in an appropriate way. It's essentially a way of waiting for everybody else to finish whatever it is they're doing, so that everybody can finish before anybody proceeds to the next step. And it can remove the need for locking in some contexts. Because if I know that all of the threads have reached the same point in code before any of them get to the next point of code, then if 2 different code regions have interdependencies between each other, but not between themselves in a single thread, then I can avoid the need to worry about race conditions and so on just by allowing them all to reach a barrier. This, I hope, will make more sense once you actually implement something where this is the natural programming construct to make things work. It's fairly common in sort of dividing a task into pieces and having multiple threads run them for more speed, that a barrier will help you out there. And we'll get to see an example of that in the life assignment coming up. So, all of that said, okay, we have talked about atomic, we've talked about lock, we've talked about reader-writer lock, and we've talked about barrier. We've talked about several different kinds of locks, the simplest being a semaphore. And we talked about the general concept that we might call the sorts of things in mutex, but then monitor is sort of the one that we most commonly use. Okay, each of these is designed to solve a different problem. So atomic operations are designed, they should be small, and they should be, we keep them from being interrupted. Okay, so we have this idea of we just take something we're going to do often, we're going to make sure all of it happens or none of it happens. Well, actually, all of it happens, but all of it happens with nothing else happening along the way. And so the particular ones we talked about the idea we can have something like an atomic plus equals if we want to have some sort of counter that we just increment, deal with the memory to do that. We did the compare and set, or compare and swap, or test and set, different names. Slightly different versions of the same thing, but this idea that I'll set memory to a new value only if it hasn't changed since the last time I looked. And so these are sort of small pieces that we can build basic operations out of. Okay, the lock, the simplest lock, is designed primarily to sort of make big atomic things. So we're going to lock other threads out of a whole block of code so that I know it will behave atomically because no other thread is accessing it while I am doing it. This could be code regions, and that's the one we talked about primarily, but it can also actually be data structure areas. And there are implementations of some data structure where potentially every value or node or group of nodes in it will have its own monitor to block access so that only one thread at a time can access that part of the data structure. Or you can lock the whole code that accesses the data structure at all. So there's different granularities there and effort overhead that comes there. Okay. The reader-writer lock is to make selective is probably a better word. Selectively atomic. Okay. So these are the ideas that we're going to have some behaviors that should behave atomically, other behaviors that it's fine to mix up. That I don't need to worry about atomicity. I don't need to worry about locking them out. but I need to lock them out of the atomic behavior. And so the reader-writer lock provides that. I have a question. Is plus equals atomic in Java and C? No. There is going to be an atomic operation that performs pretty much all of your augmented assign. So plus equals, times equals, and so on. There will be an atomic version of it, but it'll be provided via some sort of special function instead of by the operator. The only place you will find a single operator like this actually being atomic that I'm aware of are languages that don't have threads, in which case it makes it sort of moot to say they're atomic. So we have small operations that are atomic at sort of the hardware operating system level. We have locks, which allow bigger blocks of code to do that, reader-writer locks, which allow us to do that selectively, and then barriers, which allow us to sort of ensure, here's maybe a better way of describing it. We can split into the sort of the past and the future. We create some part in code where once you reach the barrier, if any thread is past that barrier, then all of the threads are past that barrier. And so even though things might be happening in parallel or other concurrent ways, at the barrier line, either everything before it is done before anything after it. And so it creates these sort of localized positions where everything lines up again. And in particular, this can remove some locks. So some kinds of locks can be removed if we know, instead of this region of code cannot be handled multiple times, that all of one region of code will happen before any of the next region of code. And that can provide us sort of a different kind of synchronization. Question about these four ideas. Okay. Let's talk about transactions. Transaction is a higher level concept. It isn't a specific primitive that we have available, but it's the idea. It's the idea that we have a set of actions that happen all or nothing. Okay. So a classic example of a transaction is purchasing something in a shop. I want the shop to provide me the good and me to provide the shop the money, or neither. And it's okay if the answer is neither. I can recover from being unable to purchase something. But I don't ever want half of that to happen and not the other half. Okay? I want this group of operations, this set of actions, to collectively happen in an all or nothing kind of behavior. And so the general concept of how this looks like in code is we will begin a transaction. Then we will do stuff. And then we will either commit the transaction, or at any point along here, we could instead roll back the transaction. Okay, let me see if I can explain how this works. Let's take the shop example. At some level, I have begun the transaction of a shop. So if I go shopping, I begin the transaction of shopping at some level when I enter the store. By entering the shop, I have sort of begun a relationship with that merchant. We've entered a transaction, okay? And then there's various things I'm going to do. I'm going to select something. I'm going to go to the checkout. I'm going to have them scan it. I'm going to pay them. They're going to bag it. And then I'm going to leave. And this is sort of the expected flow. Then I'll go through all of these steps And at the end, I will walk away with the thing I have purchased in a bag on my person, and the shop owner will have more money, and everything will be fine. However, at any point here, I can roll back the entire transaction. I can, at any point along the way, either I or the merchant can cause the whole thing to not happen. So if it comes along here, for example, that I decide after paying that the transaction isn't going to happen, then I'm going to get my money back as if I hadn't paid, because I'm not getting the option, right? Any point along the way here, whether it's really early on, I walk in and walk out, or if it's after I look around and pick something, but then I decide to buy it, any point I go in here, I can abandon the whole transaction and undo all of the steps I have begun doing and leave the shop as if I had never entered. This is the concept we want to have in a transaction. And transactions are useful clearly in sort of a commerce circumstance, but there's a lot of other circumstances where we want to be able to have sort of a set of actions that happen all together or not at all. Another kind of example we might consider, if we think about sort of a pointer-based data structure, I don't know, how about a linked list? We think about a doubly linked list, okay? I might have an initial position where I have some sort of arrangement of nodes. And if I want to insert something into this or remove something from it, let's actually do the removing because it's gonna make the picture slightly easier. I want to change this pointer to be over there and that pointer to be over there and this to get freed. I want all three of those operations to happen together. I never want a subset of them to occur without the other subset. And I could imagine a circumstance where I would have this remove method of my list be able to return a failure code, so I was unable to remove it. But if it fails, it should fail entirely, as opposed to only in part. So there's various circumstances where I have a set of operations that for the future sanity of the world have to happen in mass. And this is the idea of a transaction. The simplest way to describe a transaction, so how would we sort of implement this? The simplest way is you use a mutex. I could lock the entire set of operations so that nothing else can happen while it's happening. I could have a shop where I enter, and while I'm in the shop, nobody else can get into the shop, and I go through all of the steps, and they sort of verify I have everything before I begin, and make sure, right, they check my money before I show up, and so they know the money's available when I need to go to pay, and if I didn't have enough money, they stop me from doing it, right? You could design this where you sort of lock everything out. But in many circumstances, this is sort of overly complicated way. And overly restrictive, I should say. It removes a lot of the parallelism. And so more commonly, when we talk about transactions, we do a try and check kind of model. By which I mean, we go through all of the steps as if we had done the whole thing. Right at the very last minute, we verify that nothing else has happened. And so we have this idea that we're going to sort of stage the transaction, act as if it was all going on. And then when we're very done, make sure it still works. Make sure I haven't spent my money on something else. Make sure the product hasn't gone to somebody else. Make sure nobody else has modified any of these pointers while I was doing it. And then send it all in together. And so often this model will look essentially like we are going to sort of have a lock. That doesn't look like much of anything. We're going to have a lock around some kind of reading activity, and then we're going to compute unlocked, and then we're going to lock again some sort of check and write kind of activity so that I can have my updating happen in sort of two chunks and allow this sort of potentially more work computation to happen in parallel with other things. And sometimes, instead of locking this, sometimes I can even set this up as a single atomic operation, a single compare and swap. It takes a little bit of extra design to make that work, but when I can make that work, we can design things that way, and we can save ourselves significant effort of not needing the overhead, the time of actually causing other threads to halt while things are going on. So this is the concept of a transaction. Okay. So more formally, an atomic transaction is a group of operations that are guaranteed to occur as if they were a single atomic operation. Appropriate use of mutexes and monitors can be used to implement this. However, you can also do it optimistically. And I have sort of here a hand-wavy example of how you might do this optimistic computation of what's going on by making copies of things and moving forward only if those copies have been unmodified. And this concludes our summary of the synchronization tools and terminology that are common in concurrent and parallel computation. Thoughts, comments, questions? Okay. We do have some. All right. Would there be an analog to you stealing an item and running out of a store? Yeah, so what would happen if I were going to try to steal things? What would it look like in this other circumstance? If we take this model where I lock something, do some work, and then lock to make a committing, I am sort of assuming the programmer will play by the rules. I'm assuming there is some special variables that are only to be handled inside of the lock. And if I were to write code that ignored that rule and modified that variable outside of the lock, right? So if I were to decide to write a variable outside of the lock, this would be like that sort of stealing approach, okay? This would be, I violated the rules of engagement, I've changed how we're doing things, and so all bets are off as to whether I can do things. There are programming languages where the compiler can actually allow you to specify some variables can only be handled in an atomic way. But most programming languages do allow you to effectively steal an item and run out of the shop. Other questions? All right. How do we actually do this? Threading is handled in different ways in different programming languages. And part of this has to do with how computing's relationship with threading has changed over the years. Early on in the days of computing, it was common to have a single large computer, a mainframe, that would run all of the work for hundreds of users all at once. And so the idea of preemptive concurrency on threading and processes was really important in those days. And then personal computers became more common, smaller computers, everybody had their own and they only had one processor. And so it really sort of went out of fashion for a while to deal with this parallelism. And then we started getting multiple cores. And so it has sort of risen again, but with sort of different constraints. And along the way, different programming languages have come out different periods in this history and had different approaches to dealing with threading and so forth. A lot of modern languages will have built into the language itself specifications about how threads work and so on. So, for example, the Go language has multiple different sort of threading implementations directly in the language that handle things very sort of obviously and cleanly. We also have languages like Rust, for example, that is designed to allow the hardware to think about threads with, or the compiler to think about threads without the programmer needing to be involved in many circumstances. C is an older language and handles everything at sort of the assembly level. And so It has what are called built-ins to do atomic operations, which are just sort of funkily named functions that will allow you to do compare and set and so forth. And then it has a library, the pthreads library, the P standing for POSIX, which is an agreement about how operating systems will be designed. And it has this pthreads library that allows you to run a small number of functions and get most of the threading that you need to handle. We're just going to start by looking at some code. So this is a program, a complete program here, that is going to take the sum of values in an array. And we will spend a little bit of time talking about it. We'll run it, show what that does, and we'll come back and talk about some more, and then talk about the principles it's made out of. First, we include what we need to include. The pthread.h library in particular is an important thing to include for threading. I have here an if-indef define indif as well. Remember, if-indef means if it is not defined. So if thread count has not been defined before I get to this line, define it to be 16. Your compiler actually has a command line flag, dash capital D, that allows you to define things when the compiler is running. And so this will allow us to compile this code with different numbers of threads, but still have the compiler know how many threads there are, which will make the code a little bit simpler. I have this struct that has two size T's and a function pointer. Remember, our function pointer syntax will be very important for pthreads. Return type, parentheses star, function name, close parentheses, parameter types. This is a pointer to a function that returns a double when given a size T. And so I said, these two size T and that thing together is a task description. And then I have this function here. Pthreads wanted to be flexible in what it can do. So the basic concept of pthreads is it's going to run a function in a new thread. The core operation is running a function in a new thread. But it wants to let any kind of function work, and so it decided the function pointer it will get will be returning a void star and accepting a void star. Void star just means a pointer to anything. And so the idea is if you want some sort of fancy 15 argument function, you make a structure with those 15 arguments and you malloc it and pass in a pointer to it. If you want to return a whole bunch of things, that's fine. You return a pointer to it. I don't know what they are. We're just going to say it's an arbitrary pointer. And so pthreads libraries almost always involve casting to and from various types in order to get the information into the correct type. So you see the very first thing I do is I turn that argument and cast it as a task description pointer. Because what I really wanted was a function that accepted three arguments, from, to, and get num. But I was only allowed to do one argument, and so I made a structure for those three arguments, and I pass in a pointer to that whole structure. The function itself just loops from the from to the to and adds the get num. So it just lets me sum up a lot of values of a function applied to an integer over a particular range. And when I'm all done, I malloc a w, store the sum, and return that a pointer to that malloc value. So this is a complicated looking way of just saying sum the function applied to different values in a fixed range, where I have to pass in that range and the function all as a task description pointer. And have to pass back the answer as a pointer as well. I have an example function. It takes the reciprocal of something, huzzah. And then I have main. Main here is going to run this code. So I set up a large number. I set up a smaller number by dividing that large number by the number of threads I have. I make an array of threads, an array of tasks. I set up each of the tasks, and then I create a pthread. Let me explain what's going on here a little bit. Okay. When your code runs main, we have a thread that runs it. All code is run in a thread. Every code you ever run is run by a thread. You can't run an instruction except in a thread. So there is a thread that is spawned when we launch the program. When the loader runs our program, it creates a thread that runs main. And unless we do something different, that thread runs all of the code in our program. It'll come along and it'll run through things. And if we happen to have some sort of loop, it's going to come and loop around that for a while. And then eventually it's going to get to the return and it's all done. And this is actually part of the reason that the terminology we use is a thread. You can imagine this sort of path of execution through the program as if it was a piece of string that we laid out through all of the pieces of code, and it can jump around, but it's just one thing. It comes in and it goes out and goes someplace else. However, we have this function, pthreadCreate. pthreadCreate, when a thread runs through pthreadCreate, it keeps going just like it does for every other function. But pthreadCreate also creates a new thread. Now, we've seen before the fork function that takes one process and creates two processes. And the fork function continues running the same spot. That turns out not to be a great model, especially when we don't have copy and write memory and so forth. It just turns out to be more use if we have, as part of the arguments here, we have a function that we want to run. And so this thread will come along and keep running. It'll return and move on about its life, but somewhere else we will have that function. Okay, it is going to be a void star function and return a void star by definition. And so when we run over pthreadCreate, a new thread pops into existence at function. And by default, unless we do anything different, it is going to run until we get to the end of the function or until we return. Just like our main thread starts at the beginning of main and ends at the end of main, can call arbitrary functions in between, but by the time main returns, it is done. Similarly, this function that we pass in here acts like the main for our new thread. So we start running at the beginning of that function, we end running at the end of that function, and that's all we have. We can't return in this thread from this function without this thread ending. And we can call pthreadCreate as many times as we want. We can create a lot of threads. Each of them can be given the same function, different functions, it doesn't really matter. They'll run through whatever function we tell them to make until they terminate. So here in our code, we create some information, and we'll talk more about these ideas in a bit here. But what we do here is you'll see I create this thread and I say I want it to run the sum array function. That should be the main function for my new thread. And the rest of this information tells me which thread am I creating, so I can talk about that thread later, and what are the arguments that thread is going to have. I also have here the ability to otherwise customize the priority and so forth of the thread that we're not doing, right? So I come in here and I say I want to create a new thread. This is the number of the thread I'm creating in my internal list of threads. And this is going to be the function that thread is going to run. Here are going to be the arguments that function is going to have. Okay? And as soon as I run pthreadCreate, that other thread comes into existence. My thread keeps running. Main thread just keeps running in this loop until it's done all the thread count. And by the end of that, if thread count was 4, I started with one thread and I'll end this function with now 5 threads running, 1 running in main and 4 running in some array. But then when I'm done, I want to find out what happened. So the other piece we have here, a thread running in a functional by itself that just vanishes isn't useful because I can't get back the return value, because a different thread was running it. And so there's a separate function, pthreadJoin. pthreadJoin is going to wait for this thread identifier to end, and when it does, store its value in answer. So find out what it returned. It actually tells us a little bit more than just what it returned. It'll tell us what returned if it returned, but if it crashed in some way, it'll tell us how it crashed. And so I can spawn a bunch of threads, each of them does some work, and when I'm done, I can collect all of those threads and find out what their answers were. Let's actually try this code. Oh, I don't have that open. Okay. Let me paste that code. Right. So let's call this, what is today? Today is 3/23. All right. So I have that code. I'm going to clang it. And it says, I don't know pthread create. No, this is a linker error. So pthreads are not linked by default. I have to give it the dash pthread command. No, this is not a standard linker command. I'm actually telling the compiler to link in a threaded way. This will change how the compiler inspects my code. It'll now inspect the code under the assumption there are multiple threads, which make it a little bit more conservative in how it optimizes things and so forth. But now I can run it. And let's look at these results. Okay, as I look at these results, I will see that my code spit out 16 of these. I am summing from some number to some number. And this is happening because in my code, I have said that the sum array should begin by printing out the bounds it is being asked to sum. So I say print those bounds. And so here it prints those bounds once in each of the threads. If I do, was it thread count? What was the name of the parameter? Thread count with no space, okay. If I were to say I just have two threads, then I'll see it only split the task into two chunks. Because back in my main function, I looped the number of thread counts and created that number of threads. Okay. Now, it prints out all of these at once because they're all happening in parallel. All of them are occurring at the same time. And I can actually see that. I can run the time function on it. The time command allows me to see how long something took. And so I see this took a minute of user time. Let's say the processor was running for a minute, but it only took half a minute of wall clock time. The real time was only half of that because it was doing all of that work in two concurrent threads. I bumped it up to four threads. Okay, and I see that I don't see much faster. It is running almost twice as much CPU time, but hardly any less wall clock time. But the second time I run it, it got a lot faster. And this actually has to do with caching. The code and so forth, it was more in memory, and so I didn't have as much caching going on. Timing things is complicated, and something we'll talk some more about in days to come. But this is the core way we deal with threads. I don't have any locks, any synchronization here except the pthread join, but I make a function that behaves like sort of the main function for each thread. It needs to take a void star and return a void star, however I want to create them is fine. And then I'm going to spawn them all off with pthread create. We will see some more examples of coding with this, including how to use some synchronizations and how to deal with some common errors. When we come back on Wednesday, we have about a minute. Well, we have some questions. Does printf have to support the synchronization? Yeah, so how does printf deal with the synchronization? Could I end up with things being interleaved? This is actually dealt with not so much by printf. What printf is a library that will run in each thread individually that prepares a big string to be sent out to standardout. And so standardout is then sent to it using the write system call. And so my operating system combined with the actual tool I'm using to display things, in this case a terminal, together can decide sort of how that works. Printf can also send multiple commands to multiple pieces at a time to be sent in instead of creating one big string. And so we can see some interleaving of that. Most terminals and so on are designed so that sort of reasonable sized outputs will be done somewhat atomically by using an internal buffer to ensure that happens. Is the timing method we used in the previous lab better than timing with Clang? So I'm not actually timing with Clang here. I'm timing with the time function. The time function allows me to put any argument I want in it, any program. I can time how long it takes to do anything I want. I could time sleeping for a minute, or a second rather. Time is a command line tool that gives me the overall wall clock time and per process thread time of an entire process. So when I run an entire program, time is a great tool. When I run time individual parts of a program, it's much better to use some sort of instrumentation inside my code like we did in the last lab. All right, we are a little bit over time. Sorry about that. I will see you, well, be seen by you all on Wednesday.